I'll call to order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety. Colleagues, today is March 2nd, and we're convened for the purpose of a public hearing on Senate Bill 5514, the budget bill of the Judicial Department. Mr. Bender, would you like to tee it up for us?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and committee members. You're scheduled to have the Judicial Department present their budget to you for the remainder of this week for 4 days. The Judicial Department is primarily funded by general fund. There are some significant other funds in their budget as well. The two primary sources, the two biggest sources of other funds would be bond proceeds that the legislature authorizes to be distributed to OJD for a number of different purposes. And they also are expenditures of fee revenues and criminal fines in the Judicial Department budget. The Judicial Department not only collects most of the criminal fines that are collected in the state, but they also spend some of them, and those expenditures are in their budget as well. The co-chair's budget framework included funding at the current service level for general funds for the Judicial Department. However, the framework also identified completion of the e-court system, which you'll be hearing much about in the next 3 days or 4 days, and support for the ongoing e-court operations as priority funding items. So those items are also identified in the co-chair's budget. The co-chair's framework did not address other funds generally and did not address bondings almost exclusively. However, they did make an exception and included bonds for implementing E-Court, which is being implemented through Article 11Q bonds in their recommendation, though they have asked this subcommittee to look at the implementation of the E-Court program and to ensure that you're comfortable with it before funding proceeds. As a result of that, we have asked OJD to go into the implementation of E-Court and funding requests specific to E-Court in more depth than the other requests at this point, and they are prepared to do that. They will be presenting to you, probably it will just take them 3 days to go through their presentation. The E-Court presentation will be focused on Wednesday. The fourth and final day we anticipate public testimony and spillover time if more than the 3 days are required for the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Bender. Mr. Chief Justice, would you and your team like to join us?
Excuse me, while they're getting ready, I just wanted to mention that the presentation that they'll be going through is found in OLIS on today's meeting date. It is the fourth item after the agenda labeled SB 5514 OJD Agency Presentation if you want to follow on your laptop.
Thank you.
Helped us with
thank you.
Co-chairs Shields and Williamson and committee members, for the record, I'm Tom Ballmer. I'm the Chief Justice, and with me is Kingsley Click, our State Court Administrator, David Moon, our Chief Financial Guru, and we're going to just give you the sort of overview this afternoon. It's a privilege to be here again to talk about what we do with the state's money and the way we try to manage it and spend it responsibly for providing justice services to all Oregonians. The judicial branch, as it's now called after we amended the Constitution a few years ago, used to be department in the Constitution. Now we call it branch, and that includes the judicial department. That's the budget that I am responsible for, and Ms. Click, the Office of Public Defense Services that you'll be hearing from next week, that provides funding for indigent criminal defense services, and the Commission on Judicial Fitness, and you'll be hearing briefly from them too. The Judicial Department is a separate branch of government. What we do is try and provide fair and accessible justice services that protect the rights of individuals, preserve community welfare and safety, and inspire public confidence. We have certain goals which we've identified and which we work to achieve every day. Access, allowing everybody to get a chance to get into court, to deal with their legal issues, protect their rights, earning the public's trust and confidence, dispute resolution. A jury trial is not the best way to resolve every dispute that occurs in the world. There are a lot of these that ought to be mediated or settled one way or another, and we try and direct people towards the right way of resolving their disputes, subject, of course, to their constitutional rights to have a jury trial on civil matters and criminal matters if they want one. We build strong partnerships with all sorts of community groups, nonprofit, other government groups, whether it's mental health providers, whether it's police departments or sheriff's offices. We work closely with dozens of stakeholders, which frankly, when talking about eCourt, one of the challenges is integrating our changes and the rapid pace with which we're moving towards eCourt with all these disparate partners, some of whom are, I've got to tell you, in the dark ages when it comes to technology. And then administration, we try and operate efficiently, and I'll talk a little bit about that. I like to put it in terms of the Oregon Constitution, which says justice shall be administered openly and without purchase, which really means impartially, completely and without delay. That's what we try to do for all Oregonians. Courts are really at the core of a lot of the things that we're trying to do to, that we as a society and that you as a legislature try to do to make things better for Oregonians. The courts themselves are pretty low profile, but what happens in court is often high profile, and it certainly is ubiquitous. It happens every day all across the state. And the courts are where we, how we move from things like crimes or criminal conduct or violations to sentences, to fines, to restitution, to victims. You have to go through the courts to get there. Children at risk, you have to go through the courts to allow the state to step in. Has the state met the requirements that it has to meet in order to intervene in family affairs? How do we keep families together if children can't remain in the families? How do we find permanency for those children as quickly and as appropriately as possible? Civil and economic disputes are pervasive in a society like ours. How do you move from those disputes to enforcing your statutory rights, your rights to receive money that's due to you, getting a judgment so you can actually enforce the right that you have by contract or otherwise? And we have, unfortunately, a lot of abuse. We have disputes among partners, among married couples, with children, and the courts are places where people can go to get restraining orders to deal with their family relationships when the law needs to be involved there. And again, all these things, from these issues that we can all identify to resolutions that can be implemented and enforced, have to go through the courts, and that's essentially what we're doing day in, day out. We were asked to talk a little bit about the major budget drivers and environmental factors. The court system is reactive by design. We can't go out and say, oh, let's go out and take on this issue. That would be interesting. That's something the legislature does. Nor can we say, gosh, that issue is too hard. This family is too problematic. We don't know what to do. We're just going to kick this one down the road. Nor can we say this PERS case that you gave us is too hard. We have to decide these cases. And that's what we do. We are reactive, but when cases come to us, they're in our lap, and we will resolve them. The drivers here are things like law changes. When you enact new laws or change existing laws, or the federal government does, changing rights or remedies or changing mandates in one way or another, that affects our workload. The ballot measures and initiatives affect our workload. I can tell you that the ballot measure, this affects your workload too. The ballot measure on recreational marijuana is affecting your workload, and it's gonna affect ours in a substantial way as these issues, you know, work their way through the legal system. Case law decisions, jurisdiction and venue changes that the legislature may enact, all affect what we do and the amount of time it requires to do it. And procedures throughout our system in civil and criminal law and family and other case types, if you say we should have more hearings in these kinds of proceedings, these juvenile proceedings or these family law proceedings, that affects what we do and the amount of resources and the amount of people it takes to do that. We have workload drivers, the volume and type of court filings, which change as populations grow. They change with the economy. We have different kinds of cases. We had a big spike in mortgage foreclosure cases, for example. That started to come down now. But guess what? It turns out that a lot of people were avoiding getting divorced during the recession. They didn't have enough money to get divorced. Now we're starting to see divorce cases tick up a little bit.
It's expensive.
As people can find they have enough money to split the sheets, so to speak.
Is that a legal term?
What? Yes.
Split the sheets.
That's a technical term.
I see.
That's a medical term. Case complexity is an important driver of our work, frankly. And many of our cases, we are seeing more complex criminal cases. We're seeing some complex civil cases. When Nike sues Adidas over people leaving with designs that Nike was going to use, that is a complex case. There are lots of parties. There's a lot of money, and those take up a lot of judicial time. We're also seeing an increase, sort of at the other end, if you will, in self-represented parties. We've always had a small number of people who were self-represented. Legal aid is able to help fewer people just because of the demand. People in poverty, you can't afford lawyers. In family law proceedings where people have to come to court in order to get divorced, in order to work out child custody and support matters, they often, in most of the cases, one party and often both parties are unrepresented, which puts a very substantial burden on staff who have to help them with the paperwork and on the judges who are handling those cases. Another workload driver is increases in treatment court services. I know a lot of you are familiar with our treatment courts, which are very effective, but they require a lot of judge and staff time. It's pretty fast for a judge to sit there, and I've gone and sat as a trial judge, and you can take one guilty plea after another. And maybe you go through all the questions, and maybe it takes 15 or 20 minutes to sentence somebody pursuant to a guilty plea, and that person can be sent to jail or to prison. But in a lot of circumstances, many people feel it is better if their real problem is untreated mental illness, drug addiction, alcohol abuse. They're a veteran who has not been able to access Veterans Administration services. If we can get them into court, not just have them plead guilty and put them in jail, but work with them and with providers who are going to help deal with the underlying issues that are causing their, or leading to, or at least a contributing cause to their criminal behavior, that can be a better result in one of these treatment courts. But that means the person is coming in essentially every week. And we've got staff setting this up too, and we're checking to see, is this person following what the court told them to? Are they getting their urinalysis? Are they coming up with clean drug tests? All that sort of stuff. It's it can be a workload issue, even though it is efficient in the longer run. Statutory deadlines and timelines and priorities. You've given us some very short timelines in dealing with some victims' rights issues. Now, we understand why it's important for courts to act quickly in giving victims notice of hearings and things like that, but that is a budget driver. Land use, we've got some deadlines. These are all, they're all appropriate, and the legislature has often said, well, put these cases at top priority. Well, we have how many cases at the top priority? 27? We have a bunch of different kinds of cases that are supposed to be top priority, so we do the best we can, but we respond to those legislative mandates. And then there are economic and demographic factors, from crime rates to poverty and unemployment levels, demographic factors, substance abuse, poverty, and so on, that affect our workload. The real driver in a lot of cases, frankly, is what state and local law enforcement is doing. If they're charging a lot of cases as felonies, that's going to increase our workload. If they're arresting and investigating and prosecuting these cases, we, as I said, are reactive, and we respond to those. So, relatedly, And this is a little bit ironic. In the recession, if there are fewer deputy district attorneys, there are fewer public defenders, for budget reasons, the workload comes down a little bit. As the economy gets better and you add more deputy district attorneys in particular counties, then the workload can go up. Availability of jail and prison space, human services staffing, and things like that, all these affect the work that we do and our budget drivers and impactful on the courts. Let me just briefly highlight some of my budget priorities, and you'll see these reflected over the next couple days in our POPs and in the details of the budget. We want to, and this is my goal, and I think the goal of all my predecessors, to improve access to the courts and timely justice by maintaining courts that are open every judicial day and that are effectively handling their cases. And I want to thank the legislature for the budget that we got last year. We had an increase for the first time in a long time, and that allowed us to stabilize the court system over the last biennium. It allowed us to end furloughs. We were actually being closed on Fridays, a number of Fridays in prior years before 2013, actually into part of 2013, but not in the current biennium. And we really appreciate that. We also appreciate the co-chair's framework this year, which would fund us at our current service level. So we need to keep the courts open every business day. That's my top priority. We need to implement eCourt. We are more than halfway through with eCourt. We started three more courts in January. A week from today, we start Lincoln and Lane, and we will be done implementing our eCourt rollout by the end of June 2016. So halfway through this biennium, we will have completed our eCourt project. Now, we have some other components that are not being rolled out on the on this time frame that are going to apply to the whole state. We're working hard on those, but we are very confident about finishing having the other 17 circuit courts and the tax court up and running on eCourt by the end of June 2016. The funding judicial compensation, this is something we can talk about more later. We have asked for, in my budget, I've asked for funding compensation at the level recommended by the Public Officials Compensation Committee in 2008, when it last met, adjusted by the Consumer Price Index since then. The last survey of states showed that Oregon was 49th of 50 states plus the District of Columbia. When you adjust for cost of living, Oregon is 50th out of 51. The laggard, not being Mississippi, we're behind Mississippi on this one. Montana is the laggard here. I'm asking for, requesting, I won't say begging, but trying to make a persuasive case for increasing court staff support for families and self-represented parties and protected persons. These are the most vulnerable people in our society. They don't come in with big law firms. They really need the courts to help them out. And an area which we're getting more and more cases on is elder law. It used to be that our guardianships were often of children, and they still are. But now we're encountering many and very difficult issues about guardianships, conservatorships for elderly people. And that is presenting sort of new issues for courts, judges, and staff, ranging from how do we help people who are hard of hearing to who are we going to appoint to be a conservator or a guardian for this person who doesn't have any close relatives in the area, but obviously needs some help just coping and has been, it's come into court one way or another. We'd like to find some permanent funding for court staff for drug and other specialty courts. Last year we were able to get some, last biennium, money from the criminal justice Commission at the very end of the session, I think, to keep these programs going. But it's always been unstable funding, and that's difficult. Hard to get somebody who's a great drug court coordinator, somebody who understands the resources that are there in the community and can work with the offenders and with the courts and with the DA's office and all the people you have to deal with, and then say, well, sorry, this is a limited duration position. We only have funding for a year. Tough to keep people in those jobs. And then finally, providing safe and suitable court facilities. The legislature has been very generous in terms of helping us to help counties provide adequate courthouses. It's a statutory responsibility of the counties. The fact is, a lot of the counties are unable to provide safe and secure court facilities, and we're working on that with, we will be with this committee and with the Capital Construction Committee as well. The sort of the flip side of some of those are the challenges. I mentioned the problems we had during the recession. We essentially lost 11% of our permanent staff positions. We closed down completely one division of the court, our Court Programs and Services Division, which was a division within the State Court Administrator's Office, and we have not recovered those lost staff positions. But we stabilized, which is good, but we stabilized at a lower level. And because of that, our delivery of core court services has meant where our counters are not staffed all day, our phone coverage is incomplete, inadequate, frankly, in some counties. And some of these aren't even phone trees, where press one to talk to this judge, press two to talk to the judicial assistant doing scheduling for this judge. It's, sorry, we don't have anybody who can answer the phone, call back tomorrow. So we do need additional staff support. This also results in longer public wait times and fewer services, interpreter services, filling out the paperwork if you're self-represented services, and delays in scheduling in getting judgments entered and in recalling warrants. Recalling warrants is something that's very important to us. If a warrant has been withdrawn or satisfied, we don't want a warrant out there so that a person who has stopped for speeding and the officer checks and there's an outstanding warrant. We're supposed to get those off the books so that if there's not an outstanding warrant, the person is not going to get arrested for not responding to a warrant that had been issued. We have increasing numbers of people, as I said, who are self-represented, and we need to figure out a way to deal with them. We know how to do it. We just need the people to do it. I mentioned uncertain funding sources for the drug treatment and specialty courts. Implementing e-court has been successful, but it is tough given our reduction in staff. If you've got a small court that only has six or seven staff people, and it's tough to take three or four of them off for training on e-court, and that has been is an ongoing challenge for us, but we're coping with that. And then finally, as I mentioned before, the safety and security issues that exist in many courthouses. In some places, like Multnomah, it's that the courthouse would fall down. In other cases, it's that there are no separate entrances or often restrooms or facilities for the defendants, the victims, the jurors, the judge, the staff. And the legislature, again, was very helpful in providing some funding for a new courthouse in Union County last biennium, and we're about to break ground there. They've solved their problems. They had some issues with some people who were using the courthouse for other services, but that was a 1930s era hospital that the hospital folks had abandoned, and so the court took it over, and now it's going to be replaced by a new courthouse, and I know that Union County and certainly our judges out there, and I personally really appreciate the legislature's support in that. So those are the ongoing challenges, and I know that many of you have served on this committee or have know a lot about the courts, and some of you may be newer to the Oregon Judicial Department budget. So I don't want to bore anybody. I don't want to belabor the fact, but I thought I'd go quickly through sort of what the court system looks like today. And it has changed a little bit for those of you I know who were on this subcommittee in prior years. Our court structure has the Supreme Court with seven judges. The Court of Appeals now has 13. A new panel was added at the last legislative session. Actually, it was added two sessions ago and then funded last session. We have one judge and three magistrates in the tax court. And then the bulk of our work is done by our 173 judges in 27 judicial districts that operate in all 36 counties. And this, when I talk to other chief justices, I realize how fortunate I am because we have a very well-organized court system. When you look at court systems around the country, it's a unified court system. We took over the operations that were run by the counties in the early 1980s, and we actually have a very well-organized system that runs it's very lean, and it runs very well compared to the situations in many other states. Municipal county justice courts, that's not part of the state-funded court system. Those are run by cities or counties, and we have no control over them. They sort of operate, come and go, frankly, sometimes on their own. People can appeal from decisions of those courts to the state court system, and we see some of those appeals. So that all our judges in the state serve six-year terms. We run on a non-partisan ballot. If there is a vacancy, the governor appoints to fill that vacancy, and the person appointed has to run at the next general election. We've got 27 judicial districts, and there they are. Most of them are one-county districts. We've got a few in rural Oregon primarily, where we have two or more counties in a single district. Frankly, we don't need 27 judicial districts. We probably need 10, but that's something we'll propose another year. It would be administratively more sensible to have fewer judicial districts. Last time we raised that, didn't go very far. But. So the Supreme Court, we've got seven of us, as I said. The court selects its own chief justice, and we hear all our cases as a panel of seven. We are the state court of last resort, so we're at the absolute last word on state statutes, state constitutional provisions. People can ask the U.S. Supreme Court to hear their case. That happens once in a blue moon. Now, every once in a while it does happen, but it has to raise a federal constitutional or statutory issue, and that's pretty rare. We take review of decisions of the Court of Appeals. We get 800 or 900 petitions from decisions of the Court of Appeals, and we allow review in maybe 50 or 60 of them. So that's our discretionary docket. And then required review, these are cases the legislature has said, these cases will go right to the Supreme Court. So direct appeals in death penalty cases, skip the Court of Appeals, the tax court, attorney discipline and judge discipline cases come directly to us, ballot title cases come directly to us, and certain citing disputes come to us, and other cases as the legislature directs. And then we have this sort of historical set of writs, but that still can be important, habeas corpus, mandamus, quo warranto, and people can file with the Supreme Court if they're imprisoned and there's no other way to get, and they say, I'm wrongly imprisoned. This is what Guantanamo, some of the cases coming out of Guantanamo were habeas corpus cases. And they said, I'm being wrongfully held. Please hear my case. And the Supreme Court and several of those said, we'll hear your case. But you may not win, but we'll hear your case. And we do that, too, sometimes. And then mandamus is when people think that some government officer is not doing something that they are required to do by law. They can file a petition with the court. And then quo warranto is people who are wrongfully, if anybody cares, people who are wrongfully holding office. And if you think somebody is wrongfully holding office, they weren't really the one who was elected, then or appointed, then one can bring a quo warranto suit, and those we hear, or at least the trial courts hear those on a more regular basis. We sometimes do. So the stats are we get 900 to 1,000 filings a year at the Supreme Court. We have a couple programs that we're operating now. We have appellate e-court. People have been e-filing briefs for years. We have not made it mandatory, but we still have more than half of our briefs are electronically filed. We webcast our oral arguments. The U.S. Supreme Court still isn't doing that, and they still do not have electronic brief filing. We have court outreach. We go out. We suspended this for a while during the really severe budget shortfalls. It was just it's a little expensive to take the show of seven of us on the road to Eastern Oregon, Gold Beach, Coos Bay, places that we've been. But we've started this up again last year. We heard cases in Newport, Astoria, La Grande, and Bend. And the Court of Appeals has a similar program. So the Court of Appeals, as I said, has 13 judges. They usually sit in three-judge panels, and they have to take every case that comes their way. You have a right of appeal from any circuit court decision, from state agency rules or other actions, and from local government decisions. Most of those go to the Court of Appeals, and they have up to 3,000 cases, sometimes a little more, 3,000 cases a year. They have a number of programs that are helpful, I think, in getting the work of the courts done. They've designated an appellate commissioner, a single individual who decides a lot of motions under the authority of the chief judge. We have an appellate settlement program. These cases, you know, a dispute between a husband and a wife over, you know, how much spousal support is to be paid, or you know, a will contest, or a dispute between two businesses and an insurance company. Some of those really ought to be settled, and we try and send those off to an appellate court settlement program, and we are able to settle a lot of those cases. We try and have our some of our circuit court judges, I mean our appeals court judges, go out and sit as trial judges, as I have done a couple times. It's just a great way to understand what happens really in the trial courts, which is where the rubber meets the road for the judicial system. And they also go out and hear oral arguments in schools. The tax court, Henry Breithaupt, I don't know how many of you know Henry Breithaupt. He's our tax court judge. He's was a terrific tax lawyer in Portland for many years. And he, with the help of several magistrates, handles a very large number of cases involving Oregon tax laws. He is one of the brightest tax lawyers in the state. Doesn't mean he's always right, but we're very lucky to have someone of Henry's experience as our tax court judge. And those appeals, as I mentioned, come directly to us. Where the rubber meets the road, as I said, really is in the circuit courts. And we have circuit courts in all 36 counties and organized into 27 judicial districts. They hear everything that comes in the door, from the most serious aggravated murder to sort of horrific sex abuse cases to minor trespass to violations, traffic violations, fish and wildlife, other game violations, juvenile delinquency, stalking orders, domestic violence orders, elder abuse. We do a lot of this protective work these days. This is, as I was saying before, the courts at the core. This is where people come if they think that they are in danger. And we try, with the assistance of law enforcement, if we issue an order, try and protect people. And often we can. That's not always possible, unfortunately. Economic functioning, the circuit courts deal with foreclosures and debt collections, with personal injury, with landlord-tenant, consumer protection, lots of employment disputes. Families in crisis, you know the gamut of family law issues that show up in the courts because they show up in front of the legislative body too. Dependency issues, child support, all sorts of domestic relations issues. And then some of the most difficult ones, like the termination of parental rights, which is a very serious determination for any court to make. And then we've got civil commitment We have post-conviction, which is a proceeding by which people can challenge their criminal convictions that's legislatively mandated. And we also have a number of probate, and as I mentioned before, the guardianship and conservatorship issues seem to be growing some. We get over 500,000 cases every year in the Oregon courts, a million cases of biennium. Some of these get resolved very quickly. Some of them are violations, and people pay the ticket, it goes away. Others go on for many years. One of our goals is to try and reduce the cost and time in resolving cases, particularly the complex ones. But many kinds of cases where there's ongoing jurisdiction, such as juvenile cases or family law disputes or treatment court, matters that are in treatment court, go on for a long time and probably need to go on for quite a while. So what do the circuit courts do? They do all sorts of things required by law. They all those cases that I mentioned, but they also work on managing their dockets. It's something I'm trying to emphasize. We can do this smarter. What are the best practices around the state? Can we implement those in the other courts? I'm trying to bring together our trial court administrators and our presiding judges with that focus in mind. And we have something we're calling the Oregon Docket Management Initiative to try and help each of our 27 judicial districts look purposefully at its docket and say, how can we do this better? How can we do it cheaper? How can we have fewer touches by the lawyers or the staff or the judge to get this case resolved while still protecting everybody's due process rights? The treatment and specialty courts are a good example of something that takes a little more time now, but hopefully leads to better outcomes. We provide arbitration and mediation programs for all sorts of cases. We have a pilot project going on right now in Deschutes County with a very informal summary divorce trial with the judge and the two parties, no lawyers, explain it to the judge. This is really for sort of small-scale cases. Let's try and get this thing resolved in the afternoon, put it to bed, you know, put it in a judgment, and resolve the case that way, rather than having people spend a lot of time and increasing animosity as often can develop in these family law cases. I'm talking sort of fast so we can move through this, but I'm happy to take questions any time.
Your Honor, I do yes, have one. Sure. Since you brought up the issue of specialty courts, this isn't exactly related to specialty courts, but I'm a little bit familiar with the batterer intervention literature. You know, a child is abused or a spouse is abused. And in my experience is that in a lot of those situations, the court refers the offender to a batterer's intervention treatment program of some sort. I was wondering, and you can get back to us through the administrative staff for sure, how it's determined the effectiveness of some of these programs, because they're a little bit different from a lot of the other funding streams, because, you know, let's say Multnomah County puts out $300,000 RFP, people need to apply for it. There's a panel that decides whether or not a particular program is good or not, and there's competition. But it seems like where the offender is paying just out of pocket, and I think they probably should pay out of pocket, that it doesn't have the same kind of RFP process. So I guess one question, and if you can get to the professional staff and they can distribute it to us, is whose job is it to determine whether or not these programs are effective? Because if we're predicating the return of an abuser to the home of a child who's been abused based on the fact that they went through this program, we should have some evidence that it actually works. And then perhaps you could also send down the chain of command, you know, how that's working in, say, your three largest counties. How did they determine which programs do offenders get referred to?
No, that's a great question. As you surmised, I can't give you an answer on my own. I will say just a couple of things that sort of spring to mind from that. That's an excellent question about those sorts of resources. Just because something's an alternative or there's some sort of treatment program out there doesn't necessarily mean it's an effective one. And we worry about that in a number of our we worry about that in terms of people who are being referred to these services. We also worry about that because we want to adopt, for example, in a drug treatment court, the tested, evidence-based program for who's going to come into that program, who's going to benefit from it. The fact is that there are good studies that show that not everybody benefits from some of these programs. They're going to fall through the hoops, and we need to fall through the the cracks, and we need to make sure that we've got limited spots in a drug treatment program that we're getting the people in there that are most likely to benefit. It's just another example of the sort of the need for making sure that we have people going to, whether it's the court participating in it or sending them to a nonprofit that has been identified as somebody that could provide this sort of treatment. And you mentioned batterers' situation, we're going to people who are using techniques that we know are going to work. Or now they're not all going to work 100%, but we know have the best chance of working there.
Right. Good. Yes. Thank you. If you could look into that.
Yeah.
Please proceed.
Yeah. So some of the other things that are happening in circuit court, as I mentioned, we have the self-represented people, and we have clerks and staff that try and help people who are represented in unrepresented, self-represented in family law cases and in FAPA hearings, the Family Abuse Protection Act. And I wanted to mention a new thing that we have just managed to roll out statewide in January, which is interactive forms. This is one way you can help people that are self-represented, is to provide them with essentially a TurboTax-like form where they can answer the questions in a questionnaire format, which then populates a document that looks like a court filing. And we have had this in Multnomah County. City of Portland actually put up the money to start, and Multnomah County Circuit Court has had for a couple years a program where a person seeking a family abuse protection order because they are at risk of being abused by an intimate family member, they can fill this out online and print it out and file it. We have now spread that statewide. So it's a questionnaire that allows somebody without a lawyer to work their way through the questionnaire and come up with a document that will pass muster in court as a petition for a restraining order. And this is turns out to be very helpful to people now around the state who are at risk of abuse and have the opportunity to try and get one of these restraining orders. We also provide
just a moment,
oh,
Your
sure.
Honor.
Yeah, go ahead. Just a question. What's the processing time if you did that particular system? How long would it take for the order to then be honored? And because I think that's an interesting process.
Let me get back to you with the exact times on that, but it's a very short timeline because we, for example, in Multnomah County, we have a video hookup from the Gateway Domestic Violence Center to the Multnomah County Courthouse. So you can file one of these orders and you can get a hearing, I assume within a couple days, mm-hmm. and or perhaps even faster in the right circumstances, and have a hearing by video with a judge who's sitting in the downtown courthouse. So obviously timing is critical on these things.
That's why I posed the question of how rapidly
right.
is the turnaround.
Well, let us get you some more information on that, Senator Winters.
Representative Williamson.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add to Senator Winter's comments or to address those. This has been fantastic. A place like the Gateway Center, if somebody who lives in Clackamas County comes in and fills out a form, it isn't until he or she gets in front of the judge in the old system that they would know that they're in the wrong courthouse. And so it delays the ability to get a protective order, where if you have a fill-in-the-box online form, it will explain to you you're in the wrong place. And so it can catch those kinds of really detrimental mistakes really early.
Thank you. So I'm going through some of the things that circuit courts do, and these are the important things that they do every day. That's why circuit court, this is where, as I said, where the rubber hits the road. This is where individuals run into both the successes and the shortcomings of the court system is in circuit court. These folks prepare and participate in a number of statutory advisory committees on criminal law, family law, court security, emergency preparedness. A lot of our circuit court judges are active participants in their communities. They're on mental health and public safety task forces. A lot of them serve on or are very active in working with nonprofits that deal with a lot of the problems in our society. And they're also flipping pancakes at the Kiwanis breakfast and things like that. Our circuit judges are very active in their communities. I work with them on a number of OJD initiatives, whether it's legislative. I'm sure you will see other circuit, maybe Ways and Means won't, but other circuit court judges are coming into this building to provide information on how certain family law initiatives, how criminal justice issues are playing out in their courts. And we appreciate the work of the circuit courts doing that. We also adopt supplemental local rules that work with the uniform trial court rules that we've established. One of the challenges, frankly, of my job is to balance statewide standards and consistency across the state in the way we run our circuit courts with local cultures. I mean, the fact is, it is different in Vail, and it's different in Klamath Falls than it is in Salem or Portland. And we need to have trial courts that will provide people due process, that will be consistent to the extent we can be, but that also honor local cultural differences when those are important to the local community. And then we try and maintain positive relationships with all the agencies that we have to work with, ranging from the Department of Corrections to state police, to sheriff's offices, to city police, and other officials. We mentioned, we just put up this slide to show where we have a variety of treatment and specialty courts. As I mentioned, these courts, especially some of the drug courts where we have very well-identified successful programs that we're using, the programs that we know are going to work, that we are getting the people who are going to be successful in these programs into the programs. And this has been a development over the last 10 to 15 years, and we're very happy with the results in a lot of these courts. I mentioned before the number of case filings we have. Our case filings are essentially stable, as this slide shows. We're at about 550,000 over the past few years. Our numbers for 2014 aren't quite in yet. As we shift to our new e-court, we're now in the process of having two different systems running at the same time. We have the old OJIN system and the new OECI system, so it takes a little while to work through all the data. This table just shows for calendar year 2013 in graphic form the information that you could pull from the previous slide. And again, you see violations, probably the largest number, just by number, 40% of all the case filings. But the time that judges and staff spend is most heavily focused on the felony and complex civil cases, even though they're a relatively small percentage of the cases that are filed. Violations and small claims represent a lot of the fines we collect, 75% of the fines, and largest number of filings, but do not take all that much court or staff time. And then juvenile, civil, domestic relations require quite a bit of judicial time because of these ongoing proceedings that we have, where the judge really has to be in the courtroom with the parties, finding out what the real situation is and trying to work towards an appropriate resolution. So here's a bar chart that sort of makes the same point. If you look, for example, at violations, 40% of our filings, but only about 3% of the judge's time, 10% of the staff time. And then in contrast, something like over in the general civil probate civil commitment heading, 17% of the cases, but a lot of judge time, 33% of the judge's time, and juvenile and domestic also showing a lot of judge time. And then felony cases, of course, are an important thing that judges spend a lot of time on as well. The state court administrator, Kingsley Click, is our top non-judge administrator, and we really rely upon Kingsley and the divisions within the state court administrator's office to help the judicial department run as smoothly as it does. She and her staff support the chief in carrying out our statutory responsibilities. They administer all these courts. We have division managers. We have a division, for example, as you'll see on the next slide, but let's not go to it yet. You know, like other large government agencies, we have an HR group. We have an IT group. They have different names. We have a financial services division. We have a general counsel division. All the things that you would expect of an agency our size. And the state court administrator's office prepares our budget, works on a large number of bills, even though we don't have very many bills. Our view is policy choices are for the legislature, and most of the bills that we have introduced are administrative bills that go towards better administration of justice. But we will, when asked, provide our thoughts on other legislation. We are often asked to provide a fiscal on bills that are going to, you know, change the laws in one way or another. So we actually track a very large number of bills in the legislature each session, even though our own bills are small in number.
Just a minute.
Yes, sir.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you. Chief Justice, thanks for bringing that up. I had several questions. You've answered the one about the revenue impact that you do work on that. We just passed a bill that's going to put a burden on judges to decide how to spend class action suit money. Are you going to train your people, or did you have an input into that bill, and how do you figure to implement training for your judges or implement that bill?
Well, Chair Shields, Representative Wisnant, we do ongoing judicial training, including civil cases. We did not have any, we were not asked to take a position. We did not take a position on that bill. Certainly there are aspects of that bill that are likely to, or could at some point, result in litigation at the trial court level or up to the Supreme Court. So that's the kind we would not have taken a policy position on. But as with other legislation that's passed, we have a judicial conference in October, and one of the things we do at the judicial conference is look at new legislation that may require us to learn something new. Let's try and figure this out. Let's give people at least make people aware of new bills that were passed by the legislature. And if that, all that and any other legislation that goes into effect, we will make sure people have an understanding of what happened.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Thank you for those responses. I just don't know how other states have done this or looked at, you know, making a judge makes a decision on a case, but on how to spend money. I just find that not within the judicial branch's responsibility, but I just think that would be difficult for you. I wish you luck. Since I have your attention, I was part of the, Mr. Chair, it's okay.
You always have my attention.
I was part of the group that we passed the bill giving you additional appeals judges. And so that's finished now. Has that helped you? Could you comment on has that helped your caseload? And final, I always talk to my judges before I come to session or during the session or whatever. And I think their next, Deschutes County, is to get the E-Court. I think we're on Lincoln and Crook finished up. I would always encourage you and your team to be, remind us legislators that you purchased a performance-based off-the-shelf system, and that's why we're having no trouble with that system, I think. So, thank you.
Well, Chair Shields and Representative Wisnett, thank you. Deschutes is up soon on June. You're up in June, right. And we're looking forward to working with the judges out there. And I know that the presiding judge and the trial court administrator are very excited about that. And we have figured out how to we did purchase an off-the-shelf system, but guess what? Nothing is really off-the-shelf. You spend a lot of time figuring out how to configure this to the way you've been doing business. How can we do business differently? But still, we've got to convert all these existing cases to the new system. It has taken just an enormous amount of work by our staff and by Tyler, our contractor. But I appreciate your comments about the program. The program is working well, and we're looking forward to rolling it out in Deschutes. I would just mention one or two other things that may not pop to your mind when you think about the courts, but are administered through the State Court Administrator's Office. We administer the Citizens Review Board, our foster care review program, and the Juvenile Court Improvement Program, which are two programs that have had a lot of success in terms of working with the courts and with interested people who may have friends or family or other involvement in juvenile court matters and foster care. Those programs are run out of the State Court Administrator's Office. We have a certified shorthand reporter program. We have a very important court interpreter certification program. And you should know that our court interpreter program wins awards nationwide. We do this efficiently. We often do interpreting by telephone or by video if we can't have the interpreter in the same room as the people for whom he or she is interpreting. We have the flexibility to do it in an efficient way. And when I talk to chief justices from other states, I come away very thankful to the legislature for giving us the money to start doing this, but also the flexibility in terms of how we implement it that allows us to do it in a very cost-effective way. So here's the State Court Administrator's Office, and you see the Chief Justice and then Kingsley Click, the State Court Administrator, right below. I might also point out, just in terms of the org chart, we do have an internal auditor, and I sit on the audit committee, and they come in and audit various aspects of our operations. The other committee that we have that is very high level now and very important to the success of eCourt is our executive sponsors committee. And Representative Wisnett, this may go to your point. When I became chief, I said, well, gosh, can't I delegate this to somebody else? I don't want to learn the details about eCourt. And I was told, no, you can't. You have to. You're a sponsor. You have to chair the sponsors meeting every month, and you have to read all the material. I don't always read all of it. But you have to read the material that is prepared by the program. You have to ask the hard questions. And that's what we've been doing under my predecessor and me for, well on 5 years now. And our program is not flawless, but one of the reasons it's working as well as it does is because we've had people like Ms. Click and our other executive sponsors, Judge Murphy from Albany and Judge Waller from Portland, as well as our terrific eCourt staff. And then we have below that, we have the divisions that you'd expect in an agency of this size. I'm not going to go into detail on that, but that's the way we're organized at this point. So let me just talk about some of the things we've been doing the last couple years to try and make the court system work better for Oregonians. just to remind you, I oversee the whole system. When you look at the statutes, it's a little scary when I look at what my responsibilities are and Kingsley Click's, because most of the authority is in the Chief Justice and the State Court Administrator. So I appoint the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals through a somewhat cumbersome statutory process. I appoint presiding judges in each of the circuit courts and the State Court Administrator. When I took this job, I was told that there was one person who was an at-will employee, and it's this one here. That's the only at-will, only person I can, you know, hire and fire at will. But the State Court Administrator really is the chief operating officer of the Oregon Judicial Department, and she is in charge of carrying out the policies of the branch through the division directors and the staff. And then we have presiding judges. In each of the 27 judicial districts, we have a presiding judge who is in charge of the local docket and the operations of the court. And in each district, although we share them in a couple of the smaller districts, we have a trial court administrator who manages the day-to-day operations of that trial court. And then we have a number of committees that help us do our work. It is a structure that essentially feeds information into, and we should probably have the arrows going both ways on some of these things, but Chief Justice decisions and State Court Administrator actions, and sort of starting up at the upper left with the presiding judges and trial court administrators, that's really our management structure. That's the way I get information. It's the way we get information from the trial courts. That's the way we send out directives. That's the way we try to implement the policy decisions that we've made. And then we have the rest of the Office of the State Court Administrator that helps coordinate legislative, budget, and policy matters. E-Court, we've talked about. Down at the bottom, we have a number of OJD committees. We have a Family Law Advisory Committee, which is a terrific group of lawyers in private practice, of judges, of legal aid folks, and others who help us work out appropriate policies in the family law area. We have a group of juvenile judges who help in that area. We have people that work on our law and policy group, works on confidentiality and privacy and related issues, a lot of which come up with E-Court. We have education programs and an education committee, and we have this juvenile court improvement program I mentioned before. The Judicial Conference is the one meeting we have every year with all judges. That's an important opportunity for all our judges to get together. The Judicial Conference is, by statute, the group of all the judges in the state, all the state court judges, and we have several committees that help the Judicial Conference with its work, Judicial Conduct, Education Committee, and then others as needed. And then the group up at the top, I'm going to talk about just for a second. This is our crew, Court Reengineering and Efficiencies Work Group. And we created this, Chief Justice DeMunis, my predecessor, created this and made me the chair. And now I passed it on to Judge Karsten Rasmussen of Lane County. And this was to respond to the budget cuts. And the point of this was, could we identify efficiencies within or potential efficiencies within the state courts that would help us do our work better and at less expense? Were there restructuring things we could do in addition to printing paper on both sides and things like that? Were there ways we could restructure the way we deliver services in some ways? This committee originally sought suggestions from throughout the department, from the Chief Justice to the most recent staff hire, and we got over 1,500 suggestions, which we then culled through and implemented some of them and worked others into E-Court. When we decided to make this committee a more permanent part of our governance group, so crew continues 5 years later. We have subcommittees that are helping us with communications. What should we be on Twitter more than we are? Is that the way to contact? And it turns out that it is, at least the younger lawyers. A lot of these younger lawyers, if the court is going to be closed or if there's a ruling in a case of theirs, Maybe the way to get them is through text messages or Twitter. And obviously we've got a website, which we need to upgrade. Everybody needs to upgrade their website. Take a look at your own and see how old some of the information is. It's always a little embarrassing. Business processes, we are using the opportunity of eCourt as a way to try and take best practices and make them consistent around the state. Just because we have 36 counties doesn't mean we have to be doing things 36 different ways. Maybe two or three ways, maybe there's one really good way. Let's try and do it that way. And then organization and structure. So CREW has been working, I rely upon that committee, which has a diverse group of judges and trial court administrators, as well as some central staff, to vet proposals that come before me and help us structure our organization, our enterprise, to deliver the best services for Oregon citizens. And it's through CREW that we recently adopted the strategic plan. We actually did update our strategic plan. This is a strategic plan we actually look at. It didn't just go on the shelf, and it's available. It's on our website, and I'll mention a little bit more about that in a minute. We've adopted this docket management initiative that I mentioned to try and reduce cost and increase the speed with which we can resolve cases, but still do so fairly. We're trying to use CREW to work on these interactive forms. I mentioned the FAPA forms, the restraining order forms. We're now working on forms, interactive forms, where you've got a questionnaire which creates a pleading that can be filed in court for small claims and for FED and for the kinds of cases where people are often self-represented. And that is an important part of our eCourt project that is moving ahead as quickly as we can move it, consistent with making sure that things work. One of the problems people run into is when they try and implement stuff before it's really ready, before it's been tested. We're trying to do that. And we're trying to promote consistency in our business processes. So we did, as I mentioned, released our strategic plan.
The shelf system.
And the
more of that.
It's interesting when you look back at this, we have the same issues that the Oregon courts had 150 years ago. How do we provide fair means of resolving disputes? How do we enforce the rules of our society, you know, the criminal statutes we have? How do we resolve disputes peacefully? We have to do it in different ways now. We have to do it, we have to have access electronically. We allow people to file, in the case of the courts that have moved on to eCourt, we are now requiring lawyers to use electronic filing. And we have gone from 70 or 80 filings a month a year ago to over 40,000 a month as of January. January 2015, we had 40,000 filings came in through eCourt, through electronically to eCourt. That was 40,000 times that people didn't have to send a messenger or to the courthouse the way we used to in the old days. And people want to be able to do this the same way they do their banking and the same way they buy things through Amazon, and we have to show them that we can do it. And so that's what we're doing. How did I get off on that? But the point is, when we looked at our strategic plan, we said, gosh, the things we're trying to do are the things we courts have been trying to do for years. It's just the way we're doing them is different. And we identified specific things that we wanted to do, and we highlight some of those here, and these sort of reflect our POPs that we'll talk about tomorrow. But implementing, continuing implementation and finishing up the eCourt, implementing the court facilities renewal plan, namely the effort to help counties get rid of or replace or repair unsafe courthouses, and we're going to be working with you on that. The docket and case flow management, improved services for self-represented people, the treatment courts, the juvenile court, effort, and we also want to automate performance measures, which is an important thing that we'll be able to do with eCourt that we really were not able to do with our old legacy technology system. So Chair Shields, Chair Williamson, that's the sort of overview that I wanted to provide. I'm sorry that it was so much me talking, but you won't hear from me very much after this. But I'm happy to answer any questions folks have, and we also have other people here who could help out if I don't know the answer.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The filings, e-filings, you said 40,000 of them. The fees that are involved in that, through how do you collect the fee? Is it on a credit card, or what is it?
I'm going to ask Kingsley Click to answer that question. Thank you.
For the record, Kingsley Click, State Court Administrator, co-chairs and members of the committee, representing Krieger. Yes, it is through credit card, and the amount is the statutory filing fee, and there's not additional costs.
Senator Bates.
I have a special interest in mental health issues, another budget, and we have some areas that have mental health courts and some that don't. We seem to think, although I've got any objective evidence, that certain courts in certain counties handle mental health cases differently than others. About a third of the people in our prisons are there for mental health reasons. Some counties seem to send unusual numbers of people to the state hospital compared to their population. What's your feel about this? Have you looked at this much? Have your work groups looked at it? And it's a growing issue for us, and a very expensive one in the OHA budget and in DHS and in corrections.
Well, Chair Shields and Chair Williamson, Senator Bates, I have not looked at that issue in particular. To the extent that people come in through the criminal side, because they may have mental illnesses, but they have been charged with a crime, this is one of the senses in which we are reactive, at least initially. The district attorneys make charging decisions, and once it's charged, then we're in there, our judges are in there with the deputy DA and a defense lawyer, and I tend to agree with you, there are inconsistencies around the state in terms of how issues involving mental health go from there. There are some places that have resources and have treatment options that might be appropriate for somebody who is mentally ill, and there are other parts of the state where they just don't have those options. And as you know, there are some very serious issues about when someone is unable to aid and assist their defense in a criminal case, and you know, being sent to the state hospital for evaluation, it is you have to, if you're going to think about alternative methods or alternative dispositions, you've got to get the DA and the public defender and other people together. We do have we have created, I have signed a Chief Justice order and created a juvenile justice mental health task force that's being chaired by Judge Waller and Judge Greif, and has some mental health experts and people from different trial courts, district attorneys, public defender, legal aid folks, to look at the, and this is sort of specifically juvenile mental health, which is even more problematic in terms of options. There just are not that many options. And I don't know if Kingsley Click's in a position to talk about what else we know about that at this point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, there are staff members involved with the aid and assist work groups that are going on that we're regularly providing information that's coming to our judges, though I don't think, as the Chief mentioned, the resolution of how best to do it is available yet. But we stay involved and have been interested in providing that.
Okay.
Any other questions? Then are we done for the day, Your Honor?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Well,
thank you very much.
We always appreciate getting out a little bit early for our next one. Mr. Bender, anything you'd like to tee up for tomorrow?
No, sir. The OJD will continue with their presentation, which will be focused on budget and policy option package requests.
Great, great. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming. This meeting is adjourned.
I already had to buy a second.
This meeting is adjourned.